and understand why I'd trashed so much of my life over it in the first place. All that crazy need seemed like a dream to me. I wondered if everyone felt that way when their compulsions passed. I didn't know. I still don't. Prisco lit out for the territories, as Gazunis so often do, and when I asked Jacobs if I could have the job, he agreed at once. There really wasn't much to it, but it spared him the task of finding some local yokel to tote the camera on and off stage, hand him his top hat, and pretend to get electrocuted. He even suggested that I play some chords on my Gibson during the demonstrations. "Something suspenseful," he instructed. "Something that will put it in the rube's heads that the girl might actually get fried." This was easy enough, switching between A minor and E, the foundation chords of House of the Rising Sun and the Spring Hill Mining Disaster, if you're interested, always suggested impending doom. I enjoyed it, although I thought that a big slow drum beat would have added something. "Don't get too wedded to the job," Charles Jacobs advised me. "I intend to move on. When the fair closes down, attendance at Bell's goes into the toilet."
"Move on where?"
"I'm not sure, but I've gotten used to traveling alone," he clapped me on the shoulder. "Just so you know." I already did. After the deaths of his wife and child, Charlie Jacobs was strictly a solo act. The visits he made to his workshop grew shorter and shorter. He began bringing some equipment back and stowing it in the small trailer he'd towed behind the bounder when he resumed his rambling. The amplifiers that weren't amplifiers didn't come. Neither did two of the four long metal boxes. I got the idea he meant to start fresh, wherever he ended up, as if he'd gone as far down one road as he could and meant to try another. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my own life, now drug-free and limp-free, that too. But traveling on with the king of high voltage wasn't it. I was grateful to him, but since I could no longer really recall the horrors of heroin addiction, any more, I suppose, than a woman who has had a baby can recall the pain of childbirth, not as grateful as you might think. Also, he scared me. So did his secret electricity. He talked about it in extravagant terms, secret of the universe, path to ultimate knowledge. But he had no more idea of what it really was than a toddler has of a gun he finds in Daddy's closet. And, speaking of closets, I snooped, okay? And what I found was a photograph album filled with pictures of Patsy, Maury, and the three of them together. The pages were well thumbed, and the binding was loose. It didn't take Sam Spade to know he looked at those pictures a lot, but I never saw him do it. The album was a secret, like his electricity. In the early morning hours of October 3rd, shortly before the Tulsa State Fair shut up shop for another year, I suffered another after-effect of the brain blast Jacobs had given me. Jacobs was paying me for my services, quite a bit more than the services actually merited, and I had rented a room by the week about four blocks from the fairgrounds. It was clear he wanted to be alone, no matter how much he liked me, if he did like me, and I felt it was high time he got his own bed back. I turned in at midnight, about an hour after we wrapped the last show of the evening, and went to sleep at once. I almost always did. With the dope out of my system, I slept well. Only that morning I woke up 2 hours later, in the weedy backyard of the rooming house. An icy rind of moon hung overhead. Beneath it stood Jamie Morton, naked save for one sock and with a piece of rubber tubing wrapped around his biceps. I have no idea where I got it, but above it the blood vessels, any one of them perfect for shooting up, bulged. Below it, my forearm was white and cold and fast asleep. "Something happened," I said. I had a fork in one hand. God knows where that came from, too. And I was poking my swollen upper arm with it over and over again. Blood was beating up from at least a dozen pricks. "Something happened. Something happened. Oh, Mother, something happened. Something, something. I told myself to stop, but at first I couldn't. I wasn't out of control, exactly, but I was out of my control. I thought of electric Jesus trundling across Peaceable Lake on a hidden rail. I was like that. Something. Stab. Something happened. Stab, stab. Something. I stuck out my tongue and bit it. The click came again, not beside my ears, but buried deep inside my head. The compulsion to speak and stab was gone, just like that. The fork tumbled from my hand. I unwrapped the makeshift tourniquet, and my forearm began to prickle as the blood rushed back into it. I looked up at the moon, shivering and wondering who or what had been controlling me, because I had been controlled. When I got back to my room, grateful not to be seen with my wing-wang dangling in the breeze, I saw I had stepped on some broken glass and cut my foot quite badly. It should have awakened me, but hadn't. Why? Because I hadn't been asleep. I was sure of it. Something had moved me out of myself and taken over, driving my body like a car. I washed my foot and got back into bed. I never told Jacobs about that experience. What good would it have done? He would have suggested that a gashed foot suffered on a little midnight stroll was a small price to pay for a miracle cure from heroin addiction, and he would have been right. Still, something happened. Closing day at the Tulsa State Fair that year was October 10th. I arrived at Jacob's Bounder around 5:30 that afternoon, and plenty of time to tune my guitar and tie his tie, a thing that had become a tradition. While I was doing it, there was a knock at the door. Charlie went to answer it, frowning. He had 6 shows to do that night, including the final one at midnight, and he didn't like being interrupted beforehand. He opened the door, saying, "If it's not important, I wish you'd come back late." And then a farmer in bib overalls and a case cap, a pissed-off Okie, if ever an Okie there was, punched him in the mouth. Jacobs went staggering back, got tangled in his own feet, and went down, narrowly avoiding giving his head a good whap on the dinette table, which might have knocked him unconscious. Our visitor barged in, bent down, seized Jacobs by the lapels. He was about Jacobs' age, but a lot bigger, and he was in a rage. This could be trouble, I thought. Of course it was already, but I was thinking of the kind that ends with an extended stay in the hospital.
"You're the reason she got took in by the police," he shouted. "God damn you, she'll have a record to follow her around for the rest of her life, like a tin can tied to a puppy dog's tail."
I didn't think. I just seized an empty pot from the sink and bonked him briskly on the side of the head. It wasn't a hard blow, but the Okie let go of Jacobs and looked at me in astonishment. Tears began leaking down the grooves on either side of his considerable beak. Charlie scooted away, propped on his hands and propelling himself with his feet. Blood was pouring from his lower lip, which was split in 2 places. "Why don't you pick on someone your own size?" I asked. Hardly reasoned discourse, I know, but when we find ourselves in that sort of confrontation, how the schoolyard comes back.
"She gotta go to court,"
he shouted at me in that out-of-tune banjo Okey accent.
"And it's that sucker's fault, that sucker right here, scuttling like a dead burn crab."
He said dead burn. He really did. I put the pot on the stove and showed him my empty hands. I spoke in my most soothing voice. "I don't know who you're talking about, and I'm sure," I almost said Charles, "I'm sure Dan doesn't either."
"My daughter. My daughter Kathy, Kathy Morris, he told her the picture was free because she got up on stage, but it wasn't free. That picture has costed her plenty, ruined a dad-burned life is what that picture did."
I put a cautious arm around his shoulders. I thought he might clobber me, but now that his initial fury had been vented, he only looked sad and bewildered. "Come on outside," I said. "We'll find a bench in the shade, and you can tell me all about it."
"Who are you?"
I was going to say Mr. Jacobs' assistant, but that sounded like pretty weak tea. My years as a musician came to my rescue. his agent.
Yeah? Can you give me compensation? Because I want it. The lawyer's fees alone about to half kill me.
He pointed a finger at Jacobs.
On account of you. Your daggum fault.
I have no idea. Charlie wiped a palm full of blood off his chin. I have no idea what you're talking about, Mr. Morris, I assure you. I had gotten Morris as far as the door, and I didn't want to lose the ground I had gained. Let's discuss this out in the fresh air. He let me lead him out. There was a refreshment stand at the edge of the employees' parking lot, with rusty tables shaded by tattered canvas umbrellas. I bought him a large Coke and handed it to him. He slopped the first inch out on the table, then drank half the paper cup in big swallows. He set it down and pressed the heel of his palm to his forehead.
I never learned not to take a cold drink like that, he said. Puts a nail in your head, don't it?
Yes, I said, and thought of standing naked in scant moonlight, poking the tines of a fork into my blood-engorged upper arm. Something happened to me, and it seemed to Kathy Morris as well. Tell me what the problem seems to be.
That picture he gave her, that's a goddarn problem. She walked around with it damn near everywhere. Her friends commenced on to making fun of her, but she didn't care. She told people, that's how I really look. I tried to shake the notion out of her one night, and Mother told me to stop. Said it would pass on its own. And it seemed to. She left the picture in a room, I don't know, 2 days or three. Went on down to the hairdressing school without it. We thought it was over.
It wasn't. On October 7th, 3 days previous, she had walked into J. David Jewelry in Broken Arrow, a town southeast of Tulsa. She was carrying a shopping bag. Both salesmen recognized her, because she'd been in several times since her star turn at Jacob's midway pitch. One of them asked if he could help her. Kathy blew past him without a word and went to the display case, where the most expensive gewgaws were kept. From her shopping bag she produced a hammer, which she used to shatter the glass top of the case. Ignoring the bray of the alarm and two cuts serious enough to warrant stitches,
"And them will leave scars,"
her father mourned. She reached in and took out a pair of diamond earrings.
"These are mine," she said. "They go with my dress."
Morris had no more than finished his story when two wide boys with security printed on their black T-shirts showed up.
"Is there a problem here?" one of them asked.
"No," I said, and there wasn't. Telling the story had finished venting his rage, which was good. It had also shriveled him somehow, and that wasn't so good. Mr. Morris was just leaving. He got up, clutching the remains of his Coke. Charlie Jacob's blood was drying on his knuckles. He looked at it, as if he didn't know where it had come from.
"Sicking the cops on him wouldn't do no good, would it?" he asked. "All he did was take a picture, they'd say. Hell, it was even free."
"Come on, sir," one of the security guys said. "If you'd like to visit the fair, I'd be happy to stamp your hand."
"No, sir," he said. "My family's had enough of this fair. I'm going home."
He started off, then turned back.
"Has he done it before, mister? Has he knocked other ones for a loop the way he knocked my Kathy?"
Something happened, I thought. Something, something, something. "No," I said, "not at all."
"Like you'd say, even if he did. You being his agent and all."
Then he went away, head lowered, not looking back. In the bounder, Jacobs had changed his blood-spotted shirt and had a dish towel filled with ice on his fattening lower lip. He listened while I told him what Morris had told me, then said, "Tie my tie for me again, will you? We're already late."
"Whoa," I said, "whoa, whoa, whoa. You need to fix her up.
the way you fixed me up, with the headphones. He gave me a look that was perilously close to contempt. Do you think Daddy Dearest would let me within a mile of her? Besides, what's wrong with her, her compulsion, will wear off on its own. She'll be fine, and any lawyer worth his salt will be able to convince the judge that she wasn't herself. She'll get off with a slap on the wrist. None of this is exactly new to you, is it? He shrugged, still looking in my direction, but no longer quite meeting my eyes. There have been after effects from time to time, yes. Although nothing quite so spectacular as Miss Morse's attempt to smash and grab. You're self-teaching, aren't you? All your customers are actually guinea pigs. They just don't know it. I was a guinea pig. Are you better now or not? Yes, except for the occasional early morning stabathon that was. Then please tie my tie. I almost didn't. I was angry with him. On top of everything else, he'd snuck out the back way and yelled for security. But I owed him. He had saved my life, which was good. I was now living a straight life, and that was even better. So I tied his tie. We did the show. In fact, we did 6 of them. The crowd hooed when the close of the fair fireworks went off, but never so loud as they did when Dan, the lightning portraits man, worked his magic. And as each girl stared dreamily up at herself on the backdrop while I switched between A minor and E, I wondered which among them would discover that she had lost a little piece of her mind. An envelope sticking under my door. Deja vu all over again, Yogi would have said. Only this time I hadn't peed in my bed. My surgically mended leg didn't ache. I wasn't coming down with the flu. And I wasn't jitter-jiving with the need to score. I bent, picked it up, and tore it open. My fifth business wasn't one for gooey goodbyes, I'll give him that. The envelope contained an Amtrak ticket envelope with a sheet of notepaper paper-clipped to it. Written there were a name and an address in the town of Nederland, Colorado. Below, Jacobs had scrawled 3 sentences. This man will give you a job, if you want it. He owes me. Thanks for tying my tie. C.D.J. I opened the Amtrak envelope and found a 1-way ticket on the Mountain Express from Tulsa to Denver. I looked at it for a long time, thinking that maybe I could turn it in and get a cash refund, or use it and make the musicians' exchange in Denver my first stop. Only it would take a while to get that groove thing going again. My fingers had gone soft and my chops were rusty. There was also the dope thing to consider. When you're on the road, dope is everywhere. The magic wore off the portraits and lightning after 2 years or so, Jacobs had said. How did I know it wouldn't be the same with cures for addiction? How could I know, when he didn't know himself? That afternoon, I took a cab to the auto body shop he'd rented in West Tulsa. It was abandoned and bare to the walls. There wasn't so much as a single snip of wire on the grease-darkened floor. Something happened to me here, I thought. The question was whether or not I'd put on those modified headphones again, given the chance to do it over. I decided I would, and in some fashion I didn't quite understand. That helped me make up my mind about the ticket. I used it, and when I got to Denver, I took the bus to Nederland, high up on the western slopes of the Rockies. There I met Hugh Yates and began my life for the third time. Chapter 7 A Homecoming, Wolfjaw Ranch, God Heals Like Lightning, Death in Detroit, Prismatics. My father died in 2003, having outlived his wife and 2 of his 5 children. Claire Morton Overton wasn't yet 30 when her estranged husband took her life. Both my mother and my eldest brother died at the age of 51. Question. Death, where is thy sting? Answer. Every fucking where. I went home to Harlow for Dad's memorial service. Most of the roads were paved now, not just ours and Route 9. There was a housing development where we used to go swimming, and a Big Apple convenience store half a mile from Shiloh Church. Yet the town was in many essential ways the same. Our church still stood just down the road from Ira Harrington's house, although Mima herself had gone to that great party line in the sky, and the tire swing still hung from the tree in our backyard. I suppose Terry's children had used it, although they'd all be too old for such things now. The rope was frayed and dark with age. Maybe I'll replace that, I thought. But why? For whom? Not my children, certainly, for I had none, and the place was no longer my place. The only car in the driveway was a battered 51 Ford. It looked like the original Road Rocket, but of course that was impossible. Dwayne Robichaux had wrecked Road Rocket 1 at Castle Rock Speedway in the first lap of its only race. Yet there was the Delco battery sticker on the trunk, and the number 19 on the side, and paint as red as blood. A crow came down and roosted on the hood. I remembered how our dad had taught all us kids to poke the sign of the evil eye at crows. "Nothing in it, but it doesn't hurt to be sure," he said. And I thought, I don't like this. Something is wrong here. I could understand Conn not having arrived. Hawaii was a lot farther away than Colorado, but where was Terry? He and his wife, Annabelle, still lived here. And what about the Bowies, the Klukies, the Paquettes, the DeWitts? What about the crew from Wharton Fuel Oil? Dad had been getting up there, but surely he hadn't outlived all of the home folks. I parked, got out of my car, and saw it was no longer the Ford Focus I'd driven off the Hertz lot in Portland. It was the 66 Galaxy my father and brother had given me for my 17th birthday. On the passenger seat was the set of hardbound Kenneth Roberts novels my mother had given me, Oliver Wiswell and Arundel and all the rest. This is a dream, I thought. It's one I've had before. There was no relief in the realization, only increased dread. A crow landed on the roof of the house I'd grown up in. Another alighted on the branch supporting the tire swing, the one with all the bark rubbed off so it stuck out like a bone. I didn't want to go in the house because I knew what I'd find there. My feet carried me forward nonetheless. I mounted the steps, and although Terry had sent me a photo of the rebuilt porch 8 years before, or maybe it was 10, the same old board, second from the top, gave out the same old, ill-tempered squawk when I stepped on it. They were waiting for me in the dining room. Not the whole family, just the dead ones. My mother was little more than a mummy, as she had been as she lay dying during that cold February. My father was pale and wizened, much as he had appeared in the Christmas card photo Terry had sent me not long before his final heart attack. Andy was corpulent. My skinny brother had put on a great deal of meat in middle age, but his hypertensive flush had faded to the waxy pallor of the grave. Claire was the worst. Her crazed ex-husband hadn't been content just to kill her. She'd had the temerity to leave him, and only complete obliteration would do. He shot her in the face 3 times, the last 2 as she lay dead on her classroom floor, before putting a bullet in his own brain. Andy, I said, what happened to you? Prostate, he said. I should have listened, baby brother. Sitting on the table was mold-covered birthday cake. As I watched, the frosting humped up, broke apart, and a black ant the size of a pepper shaker crawled out. It trundled up my dead brother's arm, across his shoulder, and then onto his face. My mother turned her head. I could hear the dry tendons creak, the sound like a rusty spring holding an old kitchen door. "Happy birthday, Jamie," she said. Her voice was grating, expressionless. "Happy birthday, son," my dad. "Happy birthday, kiddo, Andy." Then Claire turned to look at me, although she had only a single raw socket to look out of. "Don't speak," I thought.
If you speak, it will drive me insane.
But she did, the words coming from a clotted hole filled with broken teeth.
Don't you get her pregnant in the back seat of that car.
And my mother nodding like a ventriloquist dummy while more huge ants crawled out of the ancient cake. I tried to cover my eyes, but my hands were too heavy. They hung limply at my sides. Behind me, I heard that porch board give out its ill-tempered squeal. Not once, but twice. Two new arrivals, and I knew who they were. No, I said, no more, please, no more. But then Patsy Jacobs' hand fell on my shoulder, and those of Tagalong Maury circled my leg just above the knee.
Something happened,
Patsy said in my ear. Hair tickled my cheek, and I knew it was hanging from her scalp, torn off her head in the crash.
Something happened,
Maury agreed, hugging my leg tighter. Then they all began to sing. The tune was Happy Birthday, but the lyrics had changed.
Something happened to you. Something happened to you. Something happened, dear Jamie. Something happened to you.
That was when I began to scream. I had this dream for the first time on the train that took me to Denver, although, fortunately for the people riding in the same car with me, my screams emerged in the real world as a series of guttural grunts deep in my throat. Over the next 20 years, I had it perhaps 24 times. I always awoke with the same panic-stricken thought. Something happened. At that time, Andy was still alive and well. I began calling him and telling him to get his prostate checked. At first, he just laughed at me. Then he grew annoyed, pointing out that our father was still as healthy as a horse and looked good to go for another 20 years or so. Maybe, I told him. But Mom died of cancer, and she died young. So did her mom. In case you didn't notice, neither of them had a prostate. I don't think that matters to the gods of heredity, I said. They just send the big C wherever it's most welcome. For Christ's sake, what's the big deal? It's a finger up your ass. It's over in 10 seconds. And as long as you don't feel both of the doctor's hands on your shoulders, you don't even have to worry about your backdoor virginity. I'll get it when I'm 50, he said. That's the recommendation, and that's what I'm going to do, and that's the end of it. I'm glad you cleaned up your act, Jamie, and I'm glad you're holding down what passes for a grown-up job in the music business, but none of that gives you the right to oversee my life. God does that for me. 50 will be too late, I thought. By the time you're 50, it will already have taken hold. Because I loved my brother, even though he had, in my humble opinion, grown up to become a moderately annoying God-botherer, I made an end run and went to Francine, his wife. To her, I could say what I knew Andy would scoff at. I'd had a premonition, and it was a strong one. Please, Francie, please, have him get that prostate exam. He compromised, just to shut you both up, by getting a PSA screening shortly after his 47th birthday, grumbling that the damn test was unreliable. Perhaps, but it was hard for even my scripture-quoting, doctor-phobic brother to argue with the result. A perfect Bo Derek 10. A trip to a Lewiston urologist followed, then an operation. He was pronounced cancer-free 3 years later. A year after that, at 51, he suffered a stroke while watering the lawn, and was in the arms of Jesus before the ambulance got him to the hospital. This was in upstate New York, where the funeral was held. There was no memorial service in Harlow. I was glad. I went home all too often in my dreams, which were a long-term result of Jacob's treatment for drug addiction. Of that, I had no doubt. I awoke from this dream again on a bright Monday in June of 2008, and lay in bed for 10 minutes, getting myself under control. My breathing eventually slowed, and I got past the idea that if I opened my mouth, nothing would come out except something happened over and over again. I reminded myself that I was clean and sober, and that was still the biggest thing in my life, the thing which had changed that life for the better. The dream came less often now, and it had been at least 4 years since I had awakened to find myself poking at my skin, the last time with a spatula, which had done zero damage. "It's no worse than a small surgical scar," I told myself. And usually I could think of it that way. It was only in the immediate aftermath that I felt something lurking behind the dream, something malevolent and female. I was sure of that, even then. By the time I was showered and dressed, the dream had receded to a faint mist. Soon it would burn off entirely. I knew this from experience. I had a second-floor apartment on Boulder Canyon Drive in Nederland. By 2008, I could have afforded a house, but it would have meant a mortgage, and I didn't want that. Being single, the apartment did me fine. The bed was a queen, like the one in Jacob's Boondocker, and there had been no shortage of princesses to share it with me over the years. There were fewer and farther between these days, but that was to be expected, I supposed. I would soon turn 52, the age, give or take a few years, when smooth Lotharios begin their inevitable transformation into shaggy old goats. Besides, I liked to see my savings account slowly fatten. I wasn't a miser by any means, but money was not an unimportant consideration to me either. The memory of waking up in the fairgrounds in sick and broke had never left me, nor had the face of the red-haired country girl when she handed back my maxed-out credit card. "Try the card again," I told her. "Honey," she had replied, "I look at you, and I don't have to." "Yeah? But look at me now, sweet britches," I thought as I drove my forerunner west on Caribou Road. I had added 40 pounds since the night I met Charles Jacobs in Tulsa, but at 6'1", 190 looked good on me. Okay, so my belly wasn't quite flat, and my last cholesterol count had been iffy, but back then I'd looked like a Dachau survivor. I wasn't ever going to play Carnegie Hall or arenas with the E Street Band, but I did still play, plenty, and I had work I liked and was good at. If a man or a woman wants more, I often told myself, that man or woman is tempting the gods. So don't tempt them, Jamie. And if you should happen to hear Peggy Lee singing that rueful old Lieber and Stoller classic, "Is That All There Is?", change the station and get some good old stomping music. 4 miles along Caribou Road, just as it starts to climb more steeply into the mountains, I turned off at the sign reading, "Wolfjaw Ranch, 2 miles. I punched my code into the gate keypad and parked in the gravel lot marked Employees and Talent. The only time I'd seen that lot full was when Rihanna recorded an EP at Wolfjaw, and that day there were more cars parked on the access road almost down to the gate. The chick had a serious entourage. Pagan Starshine, real name Hillary Katz, would have fed the horses 2 hours ago, but I went down the double line of stalls anyway, giving them apple slices and pieces of carrots. Most were big and beautiful. I sometimes thought of them as Cadillac limos on 4 feet. My favorite, however, was more of a beat-up Chevrolet. Bartleby, a dapple gray with no bloodline to speak of, had been at Wolfjaw when I arrived with nothing but a guitar, a duffel bag, and a bad case of nerves, and he hadn't been young then. Most of his teeth had gone the way of the blue suede shoe years ago, but he chewed his apple slice with the few he had left, jaws ruminating lazily from side to side. His mild dark eyes never left my face. "You good business, Bart," I said, stroking his muzzle. "And I just love good business." He nodded, as if to say he knew it. Pagan Starshine, Peg, to her friends, was feeding the chickens out of her apron. She couldn't wave, so she gave me a big rusty halloo, followed by the first 2 lines of "Mashed Potato Time." I joined her on the next two. "It's the latest, it's the greatest, etc., etc." Pagan used to sing backup, and when she was in her prime, she sounded like one of the Pointer Sisters. She also smoked like a chimney, and by the age of 40, she sounded more like Joe Cocker at Woodstock. Studio One was closed and dark. I lit it up and checked the bulletin board for that day's sessions. There were four, one at 10, one at 2, one at 6, and one at 9 that would probably go on until past midnight. Studio Two would be just as stacked. Nederland is a tiny burg nestled up on the western slope where the air is rare. Less than 1,500 full-time residents. But it has a vital musical presence out of all proportion to its size. The bumper stickers reading, "Nederland, where Nashville gets high," aren't a total exaggeration. Joe Walsh recorded his first album in Wolf Jaw One when Hugh Yates's father ran the place, and John Denver recorded his last in Wolf Jaw Two. Hugh once played me outtakes of Denver talking to his band about an experimental plane he just bought, something called a Long Easy. Listening to it gave me the creeps. There were 9 downtown bars where you could hear live music any night of the week, and 3 recording operations besides ours. Wolfjaw Ranch was the biggest and best, though. On the day I stepped timidly into Hugh's office and told him Charles Jacobs had sent me, there were at least 2 dozen pictures on his walls, including Eddie Van Halen, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Axl Rose in his prime, and U2. Yet the one he was proudest of, and the only one he was in himself, was of the Staples Singers.
"Mavis Staples is a goddess," he told me. "The best woman singer in America. No one else even comes close."
I had recorded on my share of cheap singles and bad indie albums during my dues-paying years on the road, but never heard myself on a major label until I filled in at a Neil Diamond session for a rhythm guitarist who had come down with mono. I was terrified that day. Sure, I would just lean over and puke on my SG. But since then I played on lots of sessions, mostly as a fill-in, but sometimes by request. The money wasn't great, but it was far from terrible. Weekends, I played with a house band at a local bar called Comstock Lode, and had been known to filch gigs on the side in Denver. I also gave music lessons to aspiring high school players at a summer program Hugh inaugurated after his father died. It was called Rock Atomic. "I can't do that," I protested to Hugh when he suggested adding this to my duties. "I can't read music."
"You can't read notes, is what you mean," he said. "You can read tablature just fine. And that's all these kids want. Fortunately for us and them, it's all most of them need. You ain't gonna find Segovia up here in the hills, my man."
He was right about that. And once my fright wore off, I enjoyed the lessons. They brought back memories of Chrome Roses, for one thing. For another, maybe I should be ashamed to say this, but the pleasure I felt working with the Rock Atomic teenagers was similar to the pleasure I got from feeding Bartleby his morning apple slice and stroking his nose. Those kids just wanted to rock, and most of them discovered they could, once they mastered a bar E, that was. Studio 2 was also dark, but Mookie McDonald had left the soundboard on. I shut everything down and made a note to talk to him about it. He was a good board guy, but 40 years of smoke and rope had made him forgetful. My Gibson SG was propped up with the rest of the instruments, because later that day I was going to play on a demo with a local rockabilly combo called Gadawana. I sat on a stool and played tennis racket style for 10 minutes or so, stuff like High Heel Sneakers and Got My Mojo Working, just limbering up. I was better now than in my years on the road, much better, but I was still never going to be Clapton. The phone rang, although in the studios it didn't actually ring, just lit up blue around the edges. I put my guitar down and answered it.
"Studio 2, Curtis Mayfield speaking."
"How's the afterlife, Curtis?" Hugh Yates asked.
"Dark. The good side is that I'm no longer paralyzed."
"Glad to hear it. Come on up here to the big house. I have something you should see."
"Jeez, man. We got somebody recording a half an hour from now. I think that C&W chick with the long legs."
"Mookie will get her set up."
"No, he won't. He's not here yet. Also, he left the board on at 2. Again."
Hugh sighed.
I'll talk to him. Just come on up.
Okay, but Hugh, I'll talk to the mookster. My job, right? He laughed.
I sometimes wonder what happened to the wouldn't-say-shit-if-he-had-a-mouthful sad sack I hired, he said. Come on, this'll blow your mind.
The big house was a sprawling ranch with Hugh's vintage Continental Park to the turnaround. The man was a fool for anything that slurped high test, and he could afford the indulgence. Although Wolfjaw did only a little better than break even, there was a lot of elderly Yates family dough in blue-chip investments, and Hugh, twice divorced, prenups and both, no children from either, was the last sprig on the Yates family tree. He kept horses, chickens, sheep, and a few pigs, but that was little more than a hobby. The same was true of his cars and a collection of big-engine pickup trucks. What he cared about was music, and about that he cared deeply. He claimed to have once been a player himself, although I'd never seen him pick up a horn or a guitar.
Music matters, he told me once. Pop fiction goes away. TV shows go away. And I defy you to tell me what you saw at the movies 2 years ago. But music lasts, even pop music, especially pop music. Sneer at raindrops keep falling on my head if you want to, but people will still be listening to that silly piece of shit 50 years from now.
It was easy enough to remember the day I met him, because Wolfjaw looked the same, right down to the midnight blue Connie with the opera windows parked in front. Only I had changed. He met me at the door on that day in the fall of 1992, shook my hand, and showed me into his office. There, he plopped into a high-backed chair behind a desk that looked big enough to land a Piper Cub on. I was nervous following him in. When I saw all those famous faces looking down from the walls, what little saliva remaining in my mouth dried up entirely. He looked me up and down, a visitor wearing a dirty AC/DC tee and even dirtier jeans, and said,
Charlie Jacobs called me. I've owed the Rev a large favor for quite a few years now. It's larger than I could ever repay, but he tells me you square it.
I stood there in front of the desk, tongue-tied. I knew how to audition for a band, but this was something different.
He said you used to be a doper.
Yes, I said, no point denying it.
He said it was big age.
Yes.
But now you're clean?
Yes. I thought he'd ask me for how long, but he didn't.
Sit down, for God's sake. You want a Coke, a beer, lemonade, iced tea, maybe?
I sat, but couldn't seem to relax against the back of my seat.
Iced tea?
Sounds good. I used the intercom on his desk.
Georgia? Two iced teas, honey.
Then to me.
This is a working ranch, Jamie, but the livestock I care about are the animals who show up with instruments.
I tried a smile, but it made me feel moronic, and I gave up on it. He seemed not to notice.
Rock bands, country bands, solo artists, they're our bread and butter. But we also do commercial jingles for the Denver radio stations and 20 or 30 recorded books each year. Michael Douglas recorded a Faulkner novel at Wolfjaw, and Georgia about Peter Pants. He's got that easygoing public persona, but whoo, what a perfectionist in the studio. I couldn't think of a reply to this, so kept silent and rooted for the iced tea.
My mouth was dry as a desert.
He leaned forward. Do you know what every working ranch needs more than anything else?
I shook my head, but before he could elucidate further, a pretty young black woman came in with two tall, ice-choked glasses of iced tea on a silver tray. There was a sprig of mint in each. I squeezed two lemon slices into my tea, but left the sugar bowl alone. During my heroin years, I'd been a bear for sugar, but since that day with the headphones and the auto body shop, any sweetness seemed cloying to me. I had bought a Hershey bar in the dining car shortly after leaving Tulsa and found I couldn't eat it. Just smelling it made me feel like gagging.
Thank you, Georgia, Yates said.
Very welcome. Don't forget visiting hours. They start at 2, and Les will be expecting you.
I'll remember.
She went out, closing the door softly behind her, and he turned back to me.
What every working ranch needs is a foreman, the one who takes care of the ranching and farming side here at Wolfjaw's Rupert Hall. He's fine and well, but my music foreman is recuperating in Boulder Community Hospital. Les Calloway. Don't suppose the name means anything to you.
I shook my head.
What about the excellent Board Brothers?
That rang a bell.
Instrumental group, weren't they? Surf sound, kind of like Dick Dale and his Deltones?
Yeah, that was them.
Kind of weird, seeing as how they all hailed from Colorado, which is about as far from both oceans as you can get. Had one top 40 hit, A Luna on a Kaya, which is very bad Hawaiian for Let's Have Sex.
Sure, I remember that. Of course I did. My sister played it about a billion times.
It's the one with the girl laughing all the way through it.
Yates grinned.
That laugh was her ticket to one-hit wonderdom. And I'm the daddy-o who put it on the record. No more than an afterthought, really. This was when my father ran the place. And the girl who's laughing her ass off also works here. Hillary Katz. Although these days she calls herself Pagan Starshine. She's sober now, but on that day she was so stoned on nitrous she couldn't stop laughing. I recorded her right there in the booth. She had no idea. It made that record, and they cut her in for $7,000. I nodded. The annals of rock are full of similar lucky accidents. Anyway, the excellent Board Brothers had one tour, then did two brokes. You know those?
I certainly did, and from personal experience.
Went broke and broke up. Les came home and went to work for me. He produces better than he ever played, and he's been my chief ramrod on the music side for going on 15 years now. When Charlie Jacobs called me, my idea was to make you Les's understudy, thinking you could earn while you learn, play some gigs on the side, all the usual shit. That's still the idea, but your learning curve better be goddamn steep, son, because Les had a heart attack last week. He's gonna be okay, so I'm told, but he's gotta lose a bunch of weight, take a bunch of pills, and he's talking about retiring in a year or so, which give me plenty of time to see if you're gonna work out.
I felt something close to panic.
Mr. Yates, Hugh.
Hugh?
I know next to nothing about A&R. The only recording studios I've ever been in are the ones where the group I was playing with paid for time by the hour. Mostly with lead guitarist's doting parents footing the bill, he said. Or the drummer's wife, waitressing 8 hours a day and hustling tips on sore feet.
Yes, that was pretty much how it went. Until wifey wised up, that was, and put him out of doors. He leaned forward. Hands clasped.
You'll either learn or you won't. The rev says you will. That's good enough for me. Got to be. I owe him. For now, all you have to do is light up the studios, keep track of AH. You know what that is, don't you?
Artist hours?
And lock up at night. I've got a guy who can show you the ropes until Les gets back. Mookie McDonald's his name. If you pay as much attention to what Mookie does wrong as to what he does right, you'll learn a lot. Don't let him keep the log, whatever you do. And one more thing. If you smoke some rope, that's your business as long as you show up for work on time and don't start a grass fire. But if I hear you're riding the pink horse again...
I made myself look him in the eye. I'm not going back to that.
A brave statement. And one I've heard many times, in a few cases from people who are now dead. Sometimes, though, it turns out to be true. I hope it'll be in your case. But just so we're clear, you use and you're gone. Favor owed or no favor owed. Are we clear on that?
We were.
Crystal.
Georgia Donlan was just as beautiful in 2008 as in 1992. But she'd put on a few pounds. There were streaks of silver in her dark hair, and she was wearing bifocals. "You don't happen to know what's got him all fired up this morning, do you?" she asked me. No clue. He started cussing, then he laughed a little, and then he started cussing again. Said he fucking knew it. Said that son of a bitch, then threw something it sounded like. And all I want to know is if somebody's going to get fired. If that's the case, I'm taking a sick day. I can't deal with confrontation. Says the woman who threw a pot at the meat delivery man last winter. That was different. That 404 son of a bitch tried to caress my butt. A 404 with good taste, I remarked. And when she gave me the stink eye, just saying. Huh. The last few minutes it's been all quiet in there. I hope he didn't give himself a heart attack. Maybe it was something he saw on TV. Or read in the paper. TV went off 15 minutes after I came in. And as far as the camera and the post, he stopped taking them 2 months ago. Says he gets everything from the internet. I tell him, Hugh, all that internet news is written by boys not old enough to shave and girls hardly out of their training bras. It's not to be trusted. He thinks I'm just a clueless old lady. He doesn't say it, but I can see it in his eyes, like I don't have a daughter who's taking computer courses at CU. Bree's the one who told me not to trust that blogger's crap. Go on now. But if he's sitting in his chair dead of vapor lock, don't call me to give him CPR. She moved away, tall and regal, the gliding walk no different from that of the young woman who had brought the iced tea into Hugh's office 16 years before. I tapped a knuckle on the door. Hugh wasn't dead, but he was slumped behind his oversized desk, rubbing his temples like a man with a migraine. His laptop was open in front of him. "Are you going to fire someone?" I asked. He looked up. "Huh?" "Georgia says if you're going to fire someone, she's taking a sick day." "Oh, I'm not going to fire anyone. That's ridiculous." "She says you threw something." "Bullshit." He paused. "I did kick the wastebasket when I saw the shit about the holy rings." "Tell me about the holy rings. Then I'll give the wastebasket another ritual kick and go to work. I've got 16 billion things to do today, including learning 2 tunes for that Gotta Wanna session. A wastebasket field goal might be just the thing to get me jump-started." Hugh went back to rubbing his temples. "I thought this might happen. I knew he had it in him. But I never expected anything quite this grand. But you know what they say. Go big or go home." "No fucking clue what you're talking about." "You will, Jamie. You will." I parked my butt on the corner of his desk. "Every morning I watch the 6 a.m. news while I do my crunches and pedal the stationary bike, okay? Mostly because watching the weather chick has its own aerobic benefits. And this morning I saw an ad for something besides magic wrinkle creams and Time Warner golden olded collections. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't fucking believe it. At the same time, I could." He laughed then. Not a this is funny laugh, but an I can't fucking believe it laugh. "So I turned off the idiot box and investigate further on the internet." I started around his desk, but he held up a hand to stop me. "First, I have to ask you if you'll go on a man date with me, Jamie, to see someone who has, after a couple of false starts, finally realized his destiny." "Sure, I guess so. As long as it isn't a Justin Bieber concert. I'm a little long in the tooth for the Beeb." "Oh, this is much better than the Beeb. Take a look. Just don't let it burn your eyes." I walked around the desk and met my fifth business for the third time. The first thing I noticed was the hokey hypnotist stare. His hands were spread to either side of his face, and he was wearing a thick gold band on the third finger of each. It was a poster on a website headed Pastor C. Danny Charles Healing Revival Tour 2008. Old Time Tent Revival, June 13th through 15th. Norris County Fairgrounds, 20 miles east of Denver, featuring former soul singer Al Stamper. Featuring the Gospel Robins with Davina Robinson and Evangelist C. Danny Charles, as seen on the Danny Charles Hour of Healing Gospel Power. Renew your soul through song. Refresh your faith through healing. Thrill to the story of the holy rings told as only Pastor Danny can. Bring hither the poor and the maimed and the halt and the blind. Compel them to come in that my house may be filled. Luke 14:21 and 23. Witness God's power to change your life. Friday the 13th, 7 p.m. Saturday the 14th, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Sunday the 15th, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. God speaks softly. 1 Kings 19:12. God heals like lightning. Matthew 24:27. Come one, come all, be renewed. At the bottom was a photo of a boy throwing away his crutches while a congregation stood watching with expressions of joyous awe. The caption below the photo read, Robert Rivard, healed of muscular dystrophy, 53007 St. Louis, Missouri. I was stunned, the way a person would be, I suppose, if he caught sight of an old friend who has been reported dead or arrested for committing a serious crime. Yet part of me, the changed part, the healed part, wasn't surprised. That part of me had been waiting for this all along. Hugh laughed and said, Man, you look like a bird flew into your mouth and you swallowed it. Then he spoke aloud the only coherent thought I had in my brain at that moment. Looks like the Rev's up to his old tricks. Yes, I said, then pointed at the reference to the book of Matthew. But that verse isn't about healing. He raised his eyebrows. I never knew you were a Bible scholar. There's a lot you don't know, I said, because we never talk about him. But I knew Charlie Jacobs long before Tulsa. When I was a little boy, he was the minister at our church. It was his first pastoral job, and I would have guessed it was his last, until now. His smile went away. You're shitting me. How old was he? 18? I think around 25. I was 6 or 7. Was he healing people back then? Not at all, except for my brother Con, that was. In those days, he was straight-up Methodist. You know, Welch's grape juice at communion instead of wine. Everyone liked him, at least until the terrible sermon. He quit after he lost his wife and son in a road accident. The Rev was married. He had a kid? Yes, Hugh considered. So he's actually got a right to at least one of those wedding rings. If they are wedding rings, which I doubt. Look at this. He went to the band at the top of the website page, put the cursor on Miracle Testimony, and clicked. The screen now showed a line of YouTube videos. There were at least a dozen. Hugh, if you want to go see Charlie Jacobs, I'm happy to tag along, but I really don't have time to discuss him this morning. He regarded me closely. You don't look like someone who swallowed a bird. You look like somebody gave you a hard punch to the gut. Look at this one vid, and I'll let you go. Halfway down was the boy from the poster. When Hugh clicked on it, I saw the clip, which was only a little over a minute long, had racked up better than 100,000 views. Not quite viral, but close. When the picture started to move, someone shoved a microphone with KSDK on it into Robert Rivard's face. An unseen woman said, Describe what happened when this so-called healing took place, Bobby. Well, ma'am, Bobby said, when he grabbed at my head, I could feel the holy wedding rings on the sides, right here, he indicated his temples. I heard a snap, like a stick of kindling wood. I might have passed out for a second or two, and then this, I don't know, warmth went down my legs, and the boy began to weep, and I could stand on him. I could walk. I was healed. God bless Pastor Danny. Hugh sat back.
I haven't watched all the other testimonials, but the ones I have watched are pretty much the same. Remind you of anything?
Maybe, I said, cautiously.
What about you?
We had never discussed the favor the Rev had done for Hugh, a favor big enough to cause the boss of Wolfjaw Ranch to hire a barely straight heroin addict on the basis of a phone call.
Not while you're pressed for time. What are you doing for lunch?
Ordering in pizza. After the C&W chick exits, there's a guy from Longmont. Sheet says he's a baritone interpreter of popular song. Hugh looked blank for a moment, then slapped his forehead with the heel of his hand.
Oh, my God. Is it George Damon?
Yeah, that's the name.
Christ, I thought that sucker was dead. It's been years, before your time. The first record he made with us was Damon Does Gershwin. Long before CDs, this was, although 8-tracks might have been around. Every song, and I mean every fucking song, sounded like Kate Smith singing God Bless America. Let Mookie handle him. They go back. If the Mookster screws up, you can fix it in the mix.
You sure?
Yes. If we're going to see the Rev's fine and holy shit show, I want to hear what you know about him first. Probably we should have had this conversation years ago.
I thought that over.
Okay. But if you want to get, you have to give. A full and fair exchange of information.
He laced his hands together on the not inconsiderable middle of his Western-style shirt and rocked back in his chair.
There's nothing I'm ashamed of, if that's what you're thinking. It's just so unbelievable.
I'll believe it, I said.
Maybe so. Before you leave, tell me what that verse in Matthew says and how you know it.
I can't quite quote it exactly after so many years, but it's something like, as the lightning flashes from east to west, covering the sky, so shall be the coming of Jesus. It's not about healing. It's about the apocalypse. And I remember it because it was one of Reverend Jacob's favorites. I glanced at the clock. The long-legged country girl, Mandy something or other, was a chronic early bird. She was probably already sitting on the steps outside Studio One with a guitar propped up beside her. But there was one thing I had to know right then. What did you mean when you said you doubted they were wedding rings?
Didn't use the rings on you, huh? When he took care of your little drug problem?
I thought of the abandoned auto body shop. Nope. Headphones.
This was in what, 1992?
Yes.
My experience with the Rev was in 1983. He must have updated his M.O. in the time between. He probably went back to the rings because they seem more religious than headphones. But I bet he's moved ahead with his work since my time. And yours. That's the Rev, wouldn't you say? Always trying to take it to the next level?
You call him the Rev. Was he preaching when you met him?
Yes and no. It's complicated. Go on, get out of here. Your girl will be waiting. Maybe she'll be wearing a miniskirt. That'll take your mind off, Pastor Danny.
As a matter of fact, she was wearing a mini, and those legs were definitely spectacular. I hardly noticed them, though, and I couldn't tell you a thing she sung that day without checking the log. My mind was on Charles Daniel Jacobs, a.k.a. the Rev, now known as Pastor Danny. Mookie McDonald bore his scolding about the soundboard quietly, head down, nodding, at the end promising he would do better. He would, too, for a while. Then, a week or two from now, I'd come in and find the board on again in one, two, or both. I think the idea of putting people in jail for smoking the rope is ludicrous, but there is no doubt in my mind that long-term daily use is a recipe for CRS, also known as can't remember shit. He brightened up when I told him he'd be recording George Damon.
I always loved that guy, the Mookster exclaimed. Everything he sang sounded like
Kate Smith singing God Bless America. I know. Have a good time. There was a pretty little picnic area in a grove of alders behind the big house. Georgia and a couple of the office girls were having their lunch there. Hugh led me to a table well away from theirs and took a couple of wrapped sandwiches and two cans of Dr. Pepper from his capacious man purse.
Got chicken salad and tuna salad from Tubby's. You choose.
I chose tuna. We ate in silence for a while, there in the shadow of the big mountains. And then Hugh said,
I also used play rhythm, you know, and I was quite a bit better than you.
Many are.
At the end of my career, I was in a band out of Michigan called Johnson Cats.
From the 70s? The guys who wore those army shirts and sounded like the Eagles?
It was actually the early 80s when we broke through, but yeah, that was us. Had four hit singles, all off the first album. And you want to know what got that album noticed in the first place? The title and the jacket, both my idea. It was called Your Uncle Jack Plays All the Monster Hits. And it had my very own Uncle Jack Yates on the cover, sitting in his living room and strumming his ukulele. Inside, lots of heaviness and monster fuzz tone. No wonder it didn't win Best Album at the Grammys. That was the era of Toto. Fucking Africa, what a piece of crap that was. He brooded. Anyway, I was in the Cats, and had been for 2 years. And that's me on a breakout record. Played the first two tour dates, then got let go.
Why? Thinking it must have been drugs back then, it always was. But he surprised me.
I went deaf.
The Johnson Cats tour started in Bloomington, Circus One, then moved on to Congress Theater in Oak Park. Small venues, warm-up gigs with local axe whackers to open. Then to Detroit, where the big stuff was scheduled to start. 30 cities with Johnson Cats as the opening act for Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band. Arena rock, the real deal, what you dream of. The ringing in Hugh's ears started in Bloomington. At first, he dismissed it as